Skyscrapers change cities. New York's Empire State Building at 1,250 feet became iconic. There's the Willis Tower in Chicago, 1,451 feet. Today, they're dwarfed by mega buildings like the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, a stunning 2,717 feet, or the Shanghai Tower in China, 2,073 feet. The fastest elevator in the world will be in the CTF Financial Center in China in 2016. It will travel at an ear-popping 20 meters or about 66 feet per second. Tall buildings are worshipped and reviled. In New York, there are super thin, needle-like skyscrapers rising at the south end of Central Park. Protesters laid down in the grass to demonstrate how the building's shadows would block the sun. So what is the latest thinking on designing tall buildings? Russell Gilchrist is design director of the Gensler Tall Buildings Practice. That's the firm behind the Shanghai Tower. He's at WBEZ in Chicago. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, we'll start with New York. The thinness is kind of frightening to see when you go right to the base and look. It feels physically impossible, like a woman whose waist is too small. She's going to snap. Talk about that. Is that because there's so little space to build on?
Yeah, by and large, I mean, the price of real estate in New York is obviously fairly high, so they're looking to try and maximize the building footprint. One of the issues with tall buildings is that it does rely on quite a lot of structure to be able to hold it up. So impossibly thin towers, as these appear to be, that there's certainly some structural challenges there. Typically in a tall building, we rely on what we call the core, really the kind of structure in the middle typically that kind of houses all the elevators and the stairs and all the building services that distribute through the building. That's usually a reinforced concrete structure that gives a backbone or stability to tall buildings. The residential buildings that you've described in New York typically are not able to have a central core in the same way, and even if they did have one, because they're primarily residential and exclusive apartments, sometimes each apartment is taking up a whole floor. What's happening in those buildings is that the structure that's holding the building up is really being moved from the middle to the outside to actually give the building a chance of actually being able to stand up in the manner you've described.
So even though these buildings are making New Yorkers talk, they're not even really megatall by definition. What does it say that most of the megatall buildings have been in Asia and the Middle East?
Well, I think that's an interesting observation because I think 30 years ago, the tallest building in the world would probably have been in the U.S., either Chicago or New York. Whereas the trend for tall building has really migrated eastwards, initially to the Middle East, Dubai in particular. And from there, it's actually migrated further east to China, where most of the tall buildings today are actually going up in China and Southeast Asia.
Is it simply because more people are moving to the cities there?
There's a lot of mass migration happening. I mean, 50% of us actually now live in a city circumstance. So in China, that figure is probably a little bit higher. You know, and other reasons might be a will for a developer to actually make a statement or an icon on a particular city.
Talk about that. A city has arrived when it can throw up a super building, a statement for the city. But obviously, a designer like yourself wants to leave a mark as well.
Yeah, of course. I think we do. But equally, I think, you know, at Gensler, we're really kind of interested in trying to develop tall buildings in a way that actually is, I guess, in a way, the lightest touch possible. So typically, we would want that to be on a kind of transport hub to mitigate the use of cars to get to work or get to your apartment. We have to worry about, you know, how we're going to circulate people through the building if you're elevating people and making people live at, you know, 600-700 meters up in the air. Having very tall buildings that are glass and steel, and how do you then deal with the kind of solar gains that we get from the sun and maximize the daylight? Because typically taller buildings in the 70s and 80s were very heavily body tinted. It looks like it's raining on the inside. Mm. They're reflecting the solar gains, but they're not allowing us to take full advantage of the daylight that one could enjoy. And the other A side effect of that is that we need to use more artificial lighting to light the spaces inside, even if it might be a very, very sunny day. And one of the biggest factors that, you know, drives the design of a building is obviously the impact of wind on a building. You can imagine that wind speeds 500-600 meters high up in the air are actually pretty important to deal with.
Well, talk about that, because we have a building here in Boston, the new John Hancock Tower. When it was put in, it pretty much created a wind shear. So people walking on the ground sometimes on windy days couldn't make it across the street. And Windows popped out on occasion.
Yes, those forces acting on the building, trying to make it move, are actually fairly significant and probably more significant than the gravity loads that you would need to deal with just to hold, you know, 100 floors up. I mean, even fairly modest buildings that are maybe only, I don't know, 300 feet high, you know, that will move. So obviously, when you're dealing with buildings that are of the height of the Shanghai Tower, you know, that movement can be quite significant at the very top. So we have to make sure that our structures are kind of engineered in such a way that the people who are actually using that building aren't in danger of the building falling down. But more importantly, that they actually can experience the use of that building and not feel uncomfortable.
You talk about elevatoring, the sort of using an elevator as a verb. Talk about how that's been revolutionized.
There have been a number of developments over the last 10, 15, 20 years. One of the other kind of constraints, if you like, in terms of designing tall buildings is your ability to be able to deliver people in a reasonable time to get to the apartment or the office level that they might work in. The higher we go, there are limits to how fast elevator speeds can actually reach, both from a kind of technological point of view, but also from a human comfort point of view, because we do have some elevators that are maybe 18 meters a second, which is pretty fast. And sometimes the impact on the human ear can be uncomfortable and you know, such high speed.
We think of elevators as being pulled by ropes. So what's the thinking there? You can't possibly have, I mean, I can't even imagine what's going to pull an elevator up almost 3,000 feet.
The technology is such that we're using roped elevators, and that's usually a steel cable. But as you've pointed out, going up that height, the cable itself becomes an enormous weight. When you think about tall buildings as well in the Middle East, when you might be dealing with 110 degrees of heat, there's also another impact in terms of how that metal rope might behave. There are some innovations that perhaps are maybe 5 years away from being even prototyped and probably 10 or 12 years from being maybe in use in a building. These would actually be electromagnetic. So the listeners may be familiar with sort of maglev kind of trains where they're kind of slightly elevated off a rail that allows them to move. Admittedly, this is on a horizontal level in a train, and on the new elevator technology, that would be on a vertical elevation. So a kind of slightly scary thought, but again, these are just kind of natural developments to try and overcome some of the limitations that we're trying to deal with at this
moment.
Using
magnets instead of ropes. And we understand, too, instead of going straight up, maybe going sideways at some point?
The thinking with this newer technology is that there might be multiple cabs in the same shaft.
So you're not waiting as long. And we understand the way it might work with more cars in one shaft. And I'm thinking, look out, you know, there's an elevator car coming. But let's say you got in the cab and rode up to the 20th floor. The cab would then shift over, move over horizontally while you got in or out. And another cab might pass you by in the main shaft.
That's exactly it. Because obviously, if we've got multiple cars in the shaft, we have to have the ability for the cars above the ones below to be able to kind of shunt across and maybe start a descent or, you know, pick up somebody that's wanting to go down the building rather than up.
Yeah. What about construction? We spoke to some architects recently about buildings that looked beautiful on paper, but then when they were erected, they burned down local trees and melted car tires because of the reflections from the windows.
What's been interesting in the development of tall buildings in Shanghai is that the Shanghai city government have become very concerned about not so much melting cars or trees or whatever, but really the effect on adjoining buildings that reflections can cause, or even people going about their business walking through the streets. They've actually introduced very stringent code requirements to make sure that you're having no impact on adjoining owners and neighbors.
Well, this also points us towards you and others wanting to make skyscrapers more sustainable. How do you do that? Thousands of people living inside?
You're right. So what we're trying to do is to use building systems and the envelope, the skin of the building, to actually minimize the running costs and the impact in terms of energy, in terms of what it takes to make those buildings run and operate.
Well, in a funny way, a huge building becomes almost a living thing because it's breathing in and breathing out. What's the newest thinking on how to best do that?
Well, I think one of the biggest changes over the last 30, 40 years is that tall buildings are generally becoming mixed use. You know, we may have a hotel or we may even have several hotels. We might have office space, we'll have retail, residential. And the idea now is that we're trying to create these vertical communities so that people have access to amenities throughout the height of the building rather than just entering at grade level and going to their apartment and doing their thing.
Do you worry about safety? What if someone gets sick and they're on the 120th floor, fires?
Well, it's a reasonable concern, but you know the situation is engineered. We have lots of computer programs that can simulate instances such as a fire. A lot of the buildings in China have what we call refuge levels, where every 12 or 15 floors, if some outbreak or even false alarm should happen, that we'd only be evacuating part of the building rather than the whole building occupants, because obviously we don't want to try and deal with one kind of emergency and then create another emergency at the base of the building where 6,000 people are trying to evacuate all at once.
Russell Gilchrist, thanks so much.
Thank you.